Consideration. Welcome to all new listeners tuning in as well. My name is Hendrik, and we encourage you to visit our websites, redeyescreations.com, redeyesmembers.com, and redeyesmobile.com. That's where you can see, read, and hear more. And also don't forget Radio 314, our latest edition, new program coming this Wednesday. You have radio314.com, or you can simply click into redeyescreations.com as well. You have all the links right from that page, right there. Carol de la Herran, originally from the United States, living in Spain for many years, and for the last 22, has been associated with the Monroe Institute. As a residential trainer and international outreach trainer, she held weekend and week-long programs in Spain and other locations around the world as her full-time work since 95. She has been a professional member and on the board of advisors of the Monroe Institute for many years. Carol holds degrees in psychology, law, and MBA, that's Master of Business Administration in International Marketing, and a doctorate of energy medicine. In 2009, Carol moved back to America to reinstate the outreach program, training new facilitators to teach weekend programs in their local areas. She later accepted the position of Director of Programs and was elected vice president by the board of directors. And then in December 2011, she was appointed to the position of executive director, president of the Monroe Institute. We are going to talk about Robert Monroe today, the man behind many of the ideas concerning out-of-body experiences, consciousness doorways, life after death, and things like HemiSync, a process used to create audio patterns containing binaural beats. It's short for hemispheric synchronization, also known as brainwave synchronization. Monroe indicated that the technique synchronizes the two hemispheres of one's brain, thereby creating a frequency-following response, and this is designed to evoke certain effects. HemiSync has been used for many purposes, including relaxation and sleep induction, learning, and memory aids, also helping those with physical and mental difficulties and reaching altered states of consciousness through the use of sound. Welcome, Carol. Thank you for talking with us here today on Red Ice Radio. It's great to have you with us. Thank you for coming on.
Very pleased to be with you.
Excellent. Now, we have certainly many things to discuss today. Our main focus here is, of course, Robert Monroe and the Institute, the kind of work that he did and his, well, legacy, I guess, what he's left after him. But maybe you could introduce Robert Monroe to our audience here at the beginning, Carol, for those who might not be familiar with him or his work.
Well, Robert Monroe was a very successful radio broadcaster and producer in the 40s and 50s in the United States. And he actually became vice president of one of the big production companies. And about in the middle of the 50s, he started thinking about what his company could do to renovate. Television was starting to come into the United States, and they were trying to decide if they actually wanted to do television. It was kind of like starting all over again with the same format, except this time you had images. And that didn't seem very exciting to him because Monroe kind of liked interesting, exciting things. He liked to do sailplaning, and he liked fast cars and things like that. So he was looking around for something different. And what he came up with at first was accelerated learning during sleep. He had heard that the Russians were doing some experimentation with this, and he thought, well, that could be a very interesting topic. But how do you get people to sleep? And as he was commuting in from outside of New York City into the city for his radio job, he noticed that the sound of the train tracks seemed to put people to sleep at a certain period of time after they'd been on the train. Even though it was morning and they shouldn't be sleepy at all, they would start nodding off. And so he was an expert in sound because of his radio work, but started thinking that sound could probably be used to help people move into this light sleep state where you could accomplish the accelerated learning. And during this process, he started experimenting with himself as the chief guinea pig. And as he did this, he started noticing kind of vibrations in his body. And after a while, these vibrations, he kind of got used to them. But one night, he was actually laying down thinking about going glider planing the next day and thinking about the winds and everything, and suddenly thought that he had fallen out of bed. And he's looking at this kind of fountain coming out of the wall, out of the floor, thinking, well, that's strange. It looks familiar. And then suddenly realized that it was the chandelier hanging from the ceiling. And realized that he was floating on the ceiling, looks down, sees his bed, his wife in bed, and starts wondering, well, who could that man in bed with my wife be if it's not me? And goes into total panic, decides he's probably died, but tries to swim back into his body, which he accomplishes. He sits up. He's totally awake now, thinking, well, if that wasn't a dream, so I didn't die, so I must have some kind of very serious brain tumor or something. So he spent probably 2 years visiting medical doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, trying to find out what was wrong with him. And they all kept saying, well, nothing's wrong with you. You seem to be in perfect health. You're very sane. You're very logical. And meanwhile, he kept having these experiences. And, you know, he was really a very normal kind of family man who had never thought about anything like this at all, never heard about it. One of the psychologists said, well, you know, that sounds like things that they do in India in ashrams. And Monroe said, oh, well, so what's an ashram and what's that all about? And they said, well, you could go there with a guru and spend 10 or so years and learn how to control this and everything. And Monroe wasn't going to do anything like that. But what he did do was decide that he was going to research it, and he built a laboratory at the back of his house, researched also at the ARE, which is Edgar Cayce's Institute for Research and Enlightenment.
Right.
Found some indication there that Edgar Cayce knew about these kind of things, but he kind of figured that the sound that he had been experimenting on with himself probably had a lot to do with it. And so he set up a laboratory and invited volunteers. Many of them came for many, many hours and listened to sounds to see if they had the same kind of experiences that he did. So we owe a big tribute also to these brave volunteers who lent their brains to being influenced by the sound. And after a while, they all started having similar kinds of experiences, out-body experiences or other kinds of mystical kinds of experiences, and helped Bob over the years refine the technology, determine which sounds worked, determine which sounds facilitated which kinds of states of consciousness.
So when was this approximately in time when he started to get into this and then later built this the lab behind his house there?
This was in 1958,
yeah. So it's pretty early on.
And he worked for many years of researching and actually didn't write his first book until the early 70s. And he actually really wasn't planning on even writing a book, but he lent it to some researchers at SRI, I believe it was SRI, and they found that his meticulous notes of each one of his experiences were so interesting that they gave it to a publisher to see if they would like to publish it. And when the publisher approached Bob, he said, "Oh, no, no, I can't publish. I mean, what would my executives think of me if, you know, they heard I was doing these kind of strange things on the side? I'm a, you know, I'm a responsible person with a big job. I can't let this out," because it was kind of his secret. And they said, "Well, don't worry about it. Nobody in, you know, a top executive in a radio corporation is going to be reading these kind of books." And so Bob let them publish it. Well, wouldn't you know, about a week later, his boss invites him and his wife to go on a trip on their yacht. And on the yacht, the executive's wife is reading a book. And she said, "Oh, well, this is Robert Monroe that wrote the book." And he had to confess that, yes, that was him. But curiously enough, after that, nobody else ever even mentioned it to him in his, you know, official work.
All right.
But his secret certainly didn't last very long.
Well, that's right. A lot of things have happened consequently, and a lot of things have unfolded in this area, and we certainly have a lot of interesting things to discuss. But if we were to begin to describe some of the things of what actually happened and how the brain was stimulated by the sounds, etc., maybe you can kind of break this down for us and tell us in the terms that we have today of how we explain what happened to Robert and his test subjects.
Well, what he later realized is that if we use slightly different sounds in each ear, and these are called binaural beats, they're maybe in one ear you listen to a tone of 100 cycles per second, and in the other ear 104 cycles per second, especially on headphones, our brain is trying to stabilize and equalize that those differences in sounds, which in nature would help us find the direction that the sound is coming from. But with headphones on, that doesn't quite work that way. And so our brain starts creating brain waves exactly equivalent to the difference between the two tones. So in this case, if we have 100 in one ear and 104 cycles in the other ear, our brain starts creating brain waves equivalent to 4 cycles per second, which happens to be delta brain waves. It's right on the edge of theta delta brain waves, mm-hmm. which is that light sleep state that he was looking for when he was trying to do the accelerated learning. And this is not something that Bob Monroe invented or discovered, but what he did do, because it had been used in audiology for doctors to test hearing. But what he did do was find an interesting application for it that was completely different and unique in facilitating different patterns of brain waves that could help people move into these different states of consciousness.
Very interesting. So I just off the bat for some people then, well, is this dangerous for the brain? What happens in the brain when you subject it to this?
Well, at first, you know, they really weren't quite sure, but he was experimenting for many, many years, and now, you know, since 58 till now, many years have passed, and it's been used in universities and hospitals, and the neurofeedback is a similar process, so it has definitely been tested now. And one of the really important things that Monroe did was identify these specific states of consciousness that can help us move like into a sleep state or a meditative state or a state where we can access more of our, you know, our intuition or our knowing that we all seem to have inside of us, but we can't usually connect to. So he identified these patterns of brain waves, and it was about the same time when the EEG was starting to be used quite extensively. And so he could see that people would move into these states of consciousness with the sound very quickly, whereas if you did it through meditation alone, you could learn to do the same things. These are not unnatural states. It's just that it took many, many years to do it compared to maybe a week or even less with using the technology.
So would you say that this is a shortcut? And with that, do you think that some who are involved in meditation would say that it's cheating of sorts?
Well, actually, they do sometimes,
yeah.
Because it is a shortcut. But, you know, on the other hand, it depends on how open-minded you are, I think, as a meditator. We had a 92-year-old Zen Buddhist monk come here to our base program, which is called the Gateway Voyage. And on about the fourth day, it's a six-day program, he wanted to speak to Monroe. And he said to Monroe, "Do you know what you're doing?" And Monroe said, "Well, you know, I've been working at it that time 40 years. I kind of think so." And he said, "Well, do you realize that these people who've never meditated are reaching states of consciousness that takes me years to teach my novices?"
Yeah.
And so he took headphones back to his ashram, which is in British Columbia in Canada, and put them all on headphones because he said, "Well, why take so many years to do this if with the use of technology we can do this so much quicker?"
That's right, and the technology developed, I guess it's called HemiSync, right? And this is what he...
Yes, yeah. HemiSync, and that's one part of it I didn't mention because that was kind of an extra gift or surprise, because as we use headphones and the sounds, we're hearing them in both ears, it starts facilitating what we would call a whole brain state. Both hemispheres, both the rational and the intuitive, are working closely together, which is considered an optimal state of brainwave functioning. And this technology facilitates that state. But the good thing about all of this, as with anything that we learn, since we're listening to it maybe several hours a day in the programs or even at home listening to it, often our brain learns and creates the new neural pathways. So we don't even need the technology after a while. We can just move straight into these states at will.
So this is a kind of a biofeedback thing that you teach your brain to go into these states, and you do it with the aid of technology in the beginning, but then what you're saying is eventually when you have done this enough, you can actually go straight into it without the aid of the technology.
Yes, and when I say enough, I mean in 1 week, participants can move into at least two, but usually four or five states of consciousness at will.
Today there are many different applications of this, and I guess variations, and there's even glasses today that produce a visual kind of...
Oh, yes.
...as well.
Yes, that's another kind of technology that can produce similar results, at least part of the results, that glasses that have little lights that flash at certain speeds of brain waves. What is kind of unique about the HemiSync, though, is that you can put many layers of sound. And so, you know, I gave you an example of like 100 and 104. But actually, in practice, the exercises have up to 35 layers of sound. And those layers, some of them are holding us or facilitating moving into, say, the 4 cycles per second, because that seems to be a very important window to consciousness, as Monroe put it. But other ones are trying to facilitate keeping us awake and alert so we can be conscious of the experiences that we have. Or other times the sounds are taking us into normal sleep cycle patterns, and so they're always one kind of predominant brainwave, but our brain is not used to having just, say, all of the brain in alpha waves. We may have alpha waves as prominent brain waves, but we're never only in alpha. It's always a combination of many.
Mm-hmm.
And hemisync kind of mirrors that in creating patterns of brain waves. And so we may be at one level very deeply relaxed or asleep, but at another level conscious of what is happening as we are asleep, because it's also facilitating higher level brain waves to keep us conscious.
So cycles per second, different cycles per second will potentially produce different results and different effects. And is it, would you say that it's generally across the board, or is this also different depending on what type of individual you are?
In general, and that's one of the things, the first things that Monroe kind of started identifying were patterns that seem to work for just about everyone. There always are some individual differences, but the main differences that we see here in programs are the personal experiences that people have in these states of consciousness, because we can facilitate, we give you tools to move into the states of consciousness, but the personal kind of experience you have will be totally different from one person to another. And that's what's really quite fascinating about all of this, because it really is a personal journey. And here at the Monroe Institute, we don't have any dogma about how things really are. Bob would always say, well, I'm giving you the tools. Go find out for yourself.
Yeah.
He said, you know, I had my experiences. I learned my little bits of truth, but you have to find other bits. And, you know, people can have some very moving kind of experiences in these deep meditative states, but other times they can be extremely joyful, or getting in touch with relatives who have passed on, or just feeling joy and bliss. It's very unique to each person, and sometimes you don't even have any experience. You kind of fall asleep. I know when I first came to the Gateway Voyage, and I was living in Spain at the time, so this was a pretty big deal for me. I came over here to this program, and I was falling asleep in all of the exercises, and they actually have a name for it called clicking out. And it's kind of like you're asleep, but you're not asleep, and you know that you weren't really asleep, but you don't know what you were doing. And so,
okay. Interesting.
You know, I was clicking out on all of the exercises and feeling very discouraged. And they said, "Oh, don't worry, your brain is getting it, even though you know you're asleep." And of course, I didn't particularly believe that, but. A little afterwards, they actually did some more research on it and found that when we click out, we seem to be processing things at an emotional level that we can't deal with on a conscious level at that moment. That's at least one of the things that seems to be happening when we click out.
Hmm.
But, you know, I was clicking out, getting very discouraged, because, especially because I had this one woman in my class who had been a nun, and she would come back from every exercise with this incredible Spielberg movie that she would be late to the class, and I was so jealous and so upset because I couldn't do anything, and I was feeling like the total black sheep. But after a couple of days, and when I say a couple, it was probably five, it suddenly started to work, and I had, you know, this incredible, incredible experience of just bliss. And it was like all I could say was, now I know what eternity must be like. This is, you know, it was just, it was nothing, but it was just everything. It was fabulous. And so as soon as I could figure out how to get back here, I was back. But, you know, in Spain in those days, this was 1990, the peseta was pretty weak and the dollar was pretty strong.
Right.
So it took me a bit to come up with enough cash to come back because of the air flights and everything. But it was something that I realized was not only giving me the opportunity to have these experiences, you know, when I was there at the program, but what really got me convinced is when I came home, I seemed to have a whole different perspective about what was going on around me. Things that used to really get me upset just didn't ruffle me at all. I was calmer. My kids were really surprised, you know, like, what happened to Mom? She's nice these days. It was quite interesting to kind of watch my reactions to things that I found really, that really got me interested in what on earth was going on here.
Interesting. So many things here we need to talk more about, of course. But and I want to get into some of the experiences, both that you had, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about Robert. But he passed away, I just want to mention that, on March 17th, 1995. So when did you originally get involved? When did you travel over to the Institute in the first time?
I came in 1990.
You came in 90. Okay, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, then, so I actually did meet Bob Monroe a number of times. I actually gave him Reiki healing a couple of times.
Did he enjoy it?
Here. Yes, he seemed, you know, he kind of gave me a test before he would accept healing. And I was outside talking to him in the parking lot, and he kind of touched my forehead. And this bird started singing, and he said, oh, okay, you're okay.
Okay.
Okay, I guess I passed some kind of test. I don't know what it was, but...
Interesting. So let's see here. I want to get back to this. I want to cover some of the theories about what actually happens when you subject the brain to the binaural feedback and all that, and what some of the different theories might be, because some might say then, all right, it might be the soul, if you will, that are actually literally in some sense pushed out of the body because of the state of the brain. I'm sure there are some that would claim that all of this is some kind of hallucination or something like that. I bet the theories varies, right?
There, of course, are many things. But it truly is very, very similar to meditative practice. And as you move into very deep, relaxed states, sometimes it feels, and it's not, when it's not absolutely sure that you physically separate something, because now they're talking about non-locality, and that, you know, a part of us is everywhere and we are in touch with everything at some level, and that if we change our focus of attention, we can focus on one of those other locales or one of those other areas of consciousness. But, you know, Monroe actually did go to be researched with out-of-body experiences, which at the time were kind of unheard of in American culture. And at the Stanford Research Institute, SRI, they actually had him there a number of times to see exactly what was going on in his brain when he went out of body, as he called it. And, you know, others call it astral travel. There's a number of different kind of names for this experience, but he kind of coined the term out-of-body experience because that's what it seemed like to him, that he could actually be in another place, consciously present while his physical body was usually, you know, on his couch or in bed. And in the laboratory, a very strange thing happened because their proof was that he was on a bed all wired up with an EEG equipment on, and he was supposed to be sleeping but trying to go out of body, which, by the way, is kind of difficult because it's not really very comfortable, and to get into these states, you have to be really relaxed. But he was pretty expert at it. So the whole idea was he was supposed to go into the next room and read a number that was on a very high shelf that he didn't have any idea about, nor did the researcher who was actually there monitoring him. And so he makes several attempts, and finally he gets what he feels out of body and immediately is distracted. Instead of from the number, he goes to the hallway where there was a woman. It turns out to be the woman who was supposed to be monitoring him was talking to a man in the hallway, and he actually picked up part of the conversation and then gets jolted back into his body. And next morning he reports that he didn't know the number, but that he had seen this woman in the hallway talking to what turns out to be her boyfriend, which is, of course, totally against the rules. She almost lost her job because of it, and reported part of the conversation. But, of course, for the scientists, their protocol said he was supposed to read the number, and he didn't get the number. All he got was the fact that she was out of the room and repeated the conversation that they had had in the hallway. And so, you know, testing this is quite curious. There are lots of different theories about whether, you know, we actually do something physically leaves the body or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a very difficult thing to measure, I guess, or test.
Well, right now at the Rhine Research Institute, we're collaborating with them on some research that is trying to test this also in a very curious way that was started back in the 1920s, but trying to see if the body weight changes as the person says that they leave their body.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have this special scale set up, but they also have some photon detectors in another room, a black room, and they have a target, and they're doing several things at once. And so the person who is on this bed, on this scale, is going out of body to the target room, which is a completely black room with the photon detector. And, you know, final results aren't in, but the first indications are, first, there were some weight changes. Secondly, the photon detectors did get much more activated at the time that the person said that they were going out of body, and she did pick the right target. So, you know, it's kind of exciting. There's research going on, but this is going on as we speak. It's only, you know, just really in its early stages, but it's kind of encouraging to see that they are getting some results that seem quite fascinating.
That's interesting. So the Rhine Research Center, that's in Durham, North Carolina, at the Duke University, right?
Yes.
And that's right at the, well, they call it the Research Triangle, don't they? And there's a number.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, interesting, well, departments, I guess, involved in that. And, I mean, it's kind of like remote viewing, I guess. There's always been a certain level of interest from the intelligence services and military in some cases as well. Is this the same case with the Rhine Research Group, then?
The same case in what regard?
Well, that there is an seem to be an interest in you know, from the point of view,
yes,
of military and you know, intelligence and all that, right?
Well, I don't know if the military have actually been in touch with Rhine Institute. They definitely were in touch with Bob Monroe in the 70s, late 70s. Skip Atwater was one of the main people involved there. He was in the military and had heard about the work that was happening here. And he was actually training remote viewers because, again, he had heard that this system was being used in Russia, and he was trying to find out if it actually worked, first of all, and secondly, if they could train people to do it in the U.S. military. And he had heard about Bob's work and came down to visit one time to kind of check out and see exactly, you know, what was going on and if this technology could some way help. And he tells a really great story because he came down and Bob said, well, kid, you know, the best way to find out what we're doing is to experiment yourself. And so he takes him and puts him on a bed, puts some headphones on him, and turns on the sounds. And as Skip is listening to the sounds, you know, his analytical mind is trying to figure out what's going on, and he's hearing the different sounds. And Bob comes in and he says, well, anything happening? And Skip kind of starts saying, well, it's interesting. And then he starts noticing that the bed is rising. And, you know, Skip says, yeah, well, yeah, the bed seems to be floating up. That's quite interesting. You have interesting technology here. And then after a while, he's into some kind of really involved experience floating through a tunnel that he kind of thought of as a straw with sugar crystals inside of it. And then Bob calls him back and says, well, it's time to go to lunch. And so when Skip, you know, finished his experience, the bed kind of came back down again. And he gets up and he's looking underneath the bed to see what kind of hydraulic system Monroe had installed underneath the bed. And Monroe says, there's no system. This is just a, you know, a mattress with springs under it. There's no system. Mm-hmm. And so Skip started thinking, oh dear, that must have been me then that was floating up.
Yeah.
And he got real interested, and so they actually ended up creating a contract with Monroe to train one remote viewer with this technology to see if it could somehow facilitate the remote viewing process. And that one remote viewer was Joe McMonagle, who's considered the best in the world by most, and he came here, used the technology over a period of months, you know, like 1 week a month he was here. And according to Bob, his precision at remote viewing, when he would move into states where his polarity, his electric polarity would change from negative to positive or positive to negative, and he was, you know, testing all of that to see the changes, he would go from like 35% accuracy to about 85%. And that was very impressive to Monroe, to the military. What Joe says, too, is that, well, you know, it may have increased my accuracy, but what I noticed most was that I was able to move into the state I needed to be in to be able to do the remote viewing in about 10 or 15 minutes instead of maybe an hour and a half of preparation.
So this could be a combination used to be able to get better results, basically. But overall, how would you say that it is different from remote viewing? Because remote viewing, you sit down and you try to not focus on anything at the same time. But what Robert Monroe was doing is more actually getting you to have an out-of-body experience. And as far as I understand remote viewing, that's not really the same thing what they're trying to achieve, correct?
No, it's not. And Monroe, by that time, because this is the late 70s, had realized that the technology is useful for many, many more things than out-of-body experience, and that on the spectrum of consciousness, the out-of-body experience is just one of the many, many possibilities. And so the out-of-body experience can be useful for some people to realize that they are more than physical matter. But it also can facilitate, and Monroe created special CDs for, well, at those days it was tapes, for Joe McMonagle for the remote viewing process. So these were specially designed exercises just for remote viewing. We actually still use those in our remote viewing programs that we do here. And, you know, in many remote viewing systems, it's a protocol where you sit at a desk with and you go through a very strict process of, it's called the protocol, where you do different things at different moments in the process, basically to get your analytical brain out of the way and be able to connect with whatever your target is.
Was that Robert that came up with that protocol of how to do that?
No, that was not. That was Ingo Swann, and he worked with the SRI on that also.
Okay.
Yeah, and then there have been a number of kind of variations of that protocol, but that one of the main ones. But, you know, there are many other variations on that kind of system. But the way Joe McMonagle does it, he moves into an altered kind of state, and he typically will be in a very deep state. And he, when he was in the military during the remote viewing, would have what we call a monitor who would be asking him the questions. And as Joe would access the answers, the monitor, who really didn't know what the target was either, would just keep trying to get more and more information from him. And then at the end of the session, Joe would draw. He's a very good drawer, like a mechanical drawing. He does that very well. He would draw his perceptions, because many times the drawings are much more accurate than what the words are.
Okay.
And so there are many ways to do remote viewing. I know Skip used to tell us about one of the remote viewers who had her special remote viewing socks that would help her get into the state of consciousness. But the way Joe does it is not using the typical protocols that many remote viewers use.
I see. Now, let's talk a little bit. I want to maybe get into this more also after the break. We'll take that a break here in a few minutes. But what do you think, what are some of the places that people could potentially visit? I mean, again, you mentioned before that some people seem to have almost like a film-like experience. And have you had any of these? And where do people go?
Well, later on when I continued doing more programs, I did start to have some of these more visual kind of experiences. And people have many different kinds of things. Sometimes things will come up from your past that seem to be released, difficulties with parents or siblings or something like that. sometimes people actually kind of get messages or basic information that can help them solve problems in their, you know, everyday life, or how to go forward with a certain project, things like that. And then the programs, we have a number of programs, and some of them are specifically set to do different tasks. Like one is to get in touch with past life work. Another program that's quite interesting is about manifestation and creation, and that's the kind of program where you physically move into states of consciousness where you can bend spoons with no effort, or you can grow seeds in your hands, or you can do things that ordinarily you just wouldn't believe possible, much less be able to do them. But as you get into these deep meditative states, certain brain potentials seem to manifest and come forward that you really don't even expect that you have. And maybe after the program is over, you don't do a great job with them, but you know that you can do it because you did it once. And that, that's kind of really mind-boggling in many ways.
Very interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the Institute and what people can learn there and what kind of things you still have available. I mean, do you, for instance, we can begin with this, I guess, do you still sell the kind of hemi-sync gear and all that, or how does that work if people want to experiment with that?
Well, it's not gear, it's CDs.
The CDs, okay, that's right.
Right now, we do have the hemi-sync CDs available. We also have another technology called spatial angle modulation, or SAM for short, which is a different kind of sound technology. It's quite new, and we're working with that, especially to move into states of what we might call hyperfocus, also very useful for mystical kind of states. It's a different kind of technology from hemi-sync, so they're very complementary. But apart from that, we have programs. We have programs here at the Institute, which are 6 days. But also in Europe and in many parts of the world, we have our 6-day programs in different countries, and we have outreach facilitators who do weekend programs. In Sweden, we actually have two people doing those programs.
All right.
And those are very helpful for people that really can't, you know, take a whole week to do a program because of maybe family or work obligations.
Definitely, and there's a different programs as well that people can take a look at. Give us the website so people know where to go, by the way.
The website is www.monroeinstitute.org, because we ORG means organization, because we are a nonprofit organization.
All right, very good. We're going to take a short break here in a little bit, then we're going to discuss more about this. It's very interesting. There's a lot of things I want to get into, again, pertaining to what people experience and other types of how this validates certain things that we perceive and think about consciousness, and even if it, to some certain degree, validates the soul, and if it in some way is related to life after death and everything. But we'll get into that in a second. So stay with us, Carol. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back with more. In our next hour, we are going to discuss where the out-of-body experiences can take you, if it's possible to visit different worlds, and if there are gateways or portals to other worlds inside the brain or our consciousness. Carol says that it's very common for experiencers to meet other beings or intelligent sentient entities while in an altered state of consciousness. What are these beings? Are they manifestations of our own mind, thought forms, or are they real beings external to ourselves? Monroe met one of them he called InSpec. De La Heron continues to specifically talk about the gateway experiment, other dimensions, dark matter, and how narrow the visible light spectrum really is. We discuss how the work at the Monroe Institute connects with Michael Persinger's work with the God Helmet, something designed to discredit the subject of so-called religious experiences, but that actually seem to indicate that there is much more to the mystery of consciousness than electrical signals firing in the brain. And this is just, as we know, from the hard problem of consciousness. Later, Carol talks about the different brain waves that we have, astral travel, and we ask about the connection to DMT as well. If you're enjoying our program and want to hear more, please check out our entire year of free programs that we have available for you on redeyescreations.com. You can also visit, of course, redeyesmembers.com and click on subscribe to sign up for a membership and get access not only to the second hour of this program with Carol, but to any of our previous programs. We have over 6 years of archive shows for you. And we have tons of gems in those archives, so I'm sure you'll be able to find something that you would enjoy and learn more from. You don't have to be a member to browse our archives or use the search function on redeyesmembers.com either, so you can see all the programs that we do have available for you. And before we proceed, I just want to let you know that our next program, we have Scott Onstott, Kevin McMahon, and Dan Tapman with us for a round table on numbers, geometry, and geomancy. And then after this, Richard Cassaro and John Lash coming on after that. We have a full list of our upcoming guests in our radio archives. Stay tuned, more on Robert Monroe, and consciousness studies is coming right up.